A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking about gait as a biometric. Can the way you walk actually identify you, like a fingerprint? Or is walking more like height, where there are a few broad categories most people fall into? And if you wanted to figure out your own gait, is there a practical way to do that? Plus, does your mood change how you walk? There's a lot here. And honestly, the timing's right. Gait recognition is moving out of labs and into the real world fast.
It really is. And the surveillance angle is what grabs headlines, but the health monitoring side might be even bigger. Think about it. Your watch already tracks your heart rate, your sleep, your blood oxygen. Gait is the next frontier, and it's one of those signals that's always broadcasting whether you want it to or not. You can't really turn off your walk.
Unless you're me. Then it's less walking and more.
So let's unpack this. Is gait really a unique identifier, or are we all just walking in a handful of ways?
Before we get to the surveillance stuff, I want to know what my walk says about me. Probably that I should do more of it.
To answer that, we need to understand what gait actually is, biomechanically speaking, and then look at what the research says about uniqueness. So let's start with the basics. The human gait cycle, one full stride from heel strike to the next heel strike of the same foot, breaks down into two main phases. You've got stance phase, where your foot is on the ground, and swing phase, where it's in the air. At normal walking speed, stance takes up about 60% of the cycle, swing about 40%.
60-40 split. That's oddly satisfying.
And within those phases, there are dozens of measurable parameters. Stride length, how far you travel in one full cycle. Cadence, steps per minute. Hip flexion, knee angle at heel strike. Ankle plantar flexion at toe off. Pelvic rotation, arm swing amplitude. The list goes on. Each of these is a continuous variable, and the combination of all of them produces what you might call a gait signature.
In theory, if you measure enough of these variables precisely enough, everyone's walk looks different. But theory and practice are different things. What does the actual data say?
This is where it gets interesting, because the evidence cuts both ways. On the uniqueness side, there's a classic study from 2009 by Kale and colleagues. They used video-based gait recognition on 100 subjects in controlled conditions and hit accuracy rates of 88 to 93%. That's pretty good. A 2020 meta-analysis that looked at over 40 studies found median accuracy of about 85% for frontal view gait recognition.
85% sounds impressive until you realize that's in lab conditions, with cooperative subjects wearing standard clothing. What happens when someone puts on a heavy coat?
That's the catch. Add covariates, different clothing, footwear, carrying a bag, walking on an uneven surface, and accuracy drops to 60 to 70%. And that's in research settings. In the real world, it's even messier. China deployed gait recognition in Shenzhen back in 2018, about 1,200 cameras. In ideal conditions, they reported accuracy around 90%. But when subjects wore heavy coats or carried umbrellas, it dropped to 70%.
That's not a biometric. That's a guess with a confidence interval. I mean, think about what that actually means in practice. If you've got 1,000 people walking through Shenzhen Station in heavy coats, the system is confidently misidentifying 300 of them. That's not a security system. That's a random number generator with delusions of grandeur.
This gets to the core of the uniqueness debate. Gait is what researchers call a soft biometric. It's not like a fingerprint where the false acceptance rate, the chance of matching the wrong person, is roughly 1 in 50,000. For gait in real-world conditions, the false acceptance rate is closer to 1 in 100, orders of magnitude less reliable.
We're not talking about a primary identifier. This is more like height, or build, or the color of your coat. Useful in combination with other things, but not enough on its own.
And there's a deeper argument against uniqueness. Most people actually fall into one of a few dozen recognizable gait archetypes. You've got intalgic gait, which is the limp you develop to avoid pain, shorter stance phase on the affected side. Trendelenburg gait, where your hip drops on the swing side because the abductor muscles are weak, so you get this characteristic waddle. Steppage gait, where foot drop means you lift your knee higher than normal to clear the ground. Parkinsonian gait, with small shuffling steps and reduced arm swing. These are well-known clinical patterns.
If you've got a bad hip, you and everyone else with a bad hip are walking roughly the same way. It's like saying all sedans have four doors. True, but not exactly a unique identifier.
The studies that claim uniqueness tend to use small datasets, 100 to 500 subjects, all walking under the same conditions. When you scale up and add real-world variability, the uniqueness claim starts to look overstated. It's a classic problem in biometrics research. Small N studies in pristine conditions produce exciting numbers that don't survive contact with the messy world.
Which makes me wonder about the technical side. How do these systems actually work? What are they measuring?
Two main approaches. The first is video-based. You set up a camera, capture someone walking, and use pose estimation algorithms. Open pose, alpha pose, those are the big ones, to extract joint positions frame by frame. You end up with a time series of coordinates for each joint, ankles, knees, hips, shoulders, elbows, wrists. Then you feed those trajectories into a classifier, usually a convolutional neural network or a recurrent model like an LSTM, and it learns to map those patterns to specific individuals.
It's not looking at your face at all. It's just tracking the motion of your joints, like a stick figure that happens to be uniquely yours.
And that's what makes it both powerful and creepy. It works from a distance, from bad angles, even when your face is obscured. A 2024 paper by Wong and colleagues took a completely different approach. They used floor vibration sensors. When you walk across a floor, you generate subtle vibrations, and those vibrations are unique enough that their system could identify individuals with 94% accuracy on a 1,000 subject dataset.
So you don't even need a camera. You just need a sensor in the floor. That's like something out of a spy novel. The building itself is watching you.
Which is simultaneously brilliant from an engineering perspective and deeply unsettling from a privacy perspective. But the second main approach is wearables. Instead of watching you from the outside, you strap an IMU, an inertial measurement unit, to your ankle or your waist or your wrist. That gives you acceleration and angular velocity data. You're measuring the gait from the inside. Feed that into a neural network and you can identify people that way too.
Which approach is more reliable?
Wearables tend to be more consistent because you're not dealing with lighting conditions, camera angles, or occlusions. But they require the person to be wearing the sensor, which limits the surveillance applications. Video is more scalable for public spaces, but it's noisier. There's a trade-off. It's the classic tension between signal quality and deployment scale.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Because your walk isn't just about your bones and muscles. It's also about your brain.
This is the part I find fascinating. Gait isn't a fixed mechanical output. It's modulated by your emotional state in real time. There was a great study in 2015 by Michalik and colleagues. They found that depressed individuals walk with shorter strides, reduced arm swing, and more vertical head movement, kind of a bobbing motion. Their gait literally looks heavier.
Like they're carrying something, or like gravity got turned up a notch.
That's exactly the right image, and it's bidirectional. A 2018 study had participants deliberately walk in a depressed style, slouched, slow, reduced arm swing, and then measured their mood afterward. They reported significantly more negative emotions. The way you walk doesn't just reflect your mood, it feeds back into it.
If I start walking like I'm confident, I actually become more confident? That feels like one of those life hacks that's either profound or complete nonsense.
There's evidence for that, yes. A 2021 study induced happiness in participants and found their stride length increased by 8% and their walking speed by 12%. These aren't subtle changes. You can see them.
That complicates the biometric argument significantly. If my gait changes by 12% depending on whether I had a good breakfast, what exactly are you matching against? Are you matching me, or are you matching my mood?
This is the stability problem, and it's the same challenge that voice biometrics face. Your voice changes when you have a cold, when you're stressed, when you're tired, but there's still a stable vocal fingerprint underneath. The question is whether gait has the same kind of invariant core. There's some evidence. A 2023 paper by Horst and colleagues took subjects and had them walk at different speeds and in different moods, happy, sad, neutral. Then they threw all that data at a neural network. Even with all that variability, the network could still identify individuals with 78% accuracy. That's not great as a standalone biometric, but it suggests there is a stable underlying signature. Something about the way your joints coordinate, maybe, that mood doesn't completely overwrite.
78%. So mood knocks about 15 points off the accuracy compared to controlled conditions.
And that's in a research setting. In the real world, you'd expect even more variability. There was a fascinating study in 2024 by Chen and colleagues at MIT. They used floor-mounted pressure sensors, not cameras, just pressure plates, to measure gait in 50 subjects before and after a stress-inducing task. They could classify stressed versus non-stress walking with 82% accuracy, based on changes in stride time variability and center of pressure displacement.
Center of pressure displacement. That's how your weight shifts across your foot as you walk, from heel to ball to toe, right?
When you're stressed, your gait becomes more variable. Your stride timing gets less consistent, and the way your weight transfers from heel to toe changes. It's subtle, but the sensors pick it up. Think of it like a seismograph for your emotional state. The floor becomes a giant stress detector.
A floor in an airport or a train station could theoretically detect that a large number of people are stressed. That's both useful for crowd management and absolutely terrifying.
Welcome to modern biometrics. Every useful application has a surveillance shadow. But let me give you the practical implications, because they cut both ways. On the security side, mood-induced gait variability is a problem. It increases false rejection rates. You show up at a biometric checkpoint, you're having a bad day, your gait is slightly off, and the system doesn't recognize you. That's annoying if it's your phone, but potentially serious if it's a border crossing.
On the health side?
That's where the variability becomes a feature, not a bug. If your gait changes persistently, shorter strides, less arm swing, slower pace over weeks, that can be an early indicator of depression. Or Parkinson's disease, which has a very characteristic gait pattern called festinating gait, where the steps get progressively shorter and faster, like you're chasing your own center of gravity. Or it can predict fall risk in elderly populations. Your watch could notice you're walking differently and alert you before you actually fall.
The same signal that makes gait a weak biometric makes it a strong health indicator. The thing that ruins it for security is exactly what makes it valuable for medicine.
The dynamism is the point. A fingerprint doesn't tell you if someone is depressed. And here's a concrete example. There's a condition called vascular dementia, which often presents with what clinicians call magnetic gait. The person walks as if their feet are magnetically attracted to the floor with a wide base and slow shuffling steps. That pattern can show up months before cognitive symptoms become obvious. Your gait is essentially a continuous neurological status report.
You're walking around broadcasting not just who you are, but how your brain is doing. A lot to process while I'm just trying to get to the kitchen.
But most of us never listen to that signal. We're not trained to notice our own gait patterns, and we certainly don't notice when they change subtly over time.
All right, so let's get practical. If I'm a listener and I want to know what my own gait looks like, what do I actually do?
You've got options, and some of them are surprisingly accessible. If you have an Apple Watch, since Watch OS 9 in 2022, you've already got gait data being collected. There's a metric called walking steadiness. It measures your step length, your double support time, that's the period when both feet are on the ground, and your gait asymmetry, which is the percentage of time your steps are uneven.
Double support time. Is that the waddling metric?
In a way, yes. Longer double support time means you're spending more time with both feet planted, which is a stability strategy. It tends to increase with age and with certain gait disorders. The Apple Watch estimates this from the motion sensors while you walk. The catch is it needs about 20 meters of flat ground walking over several days to establish a baseline. It's not a one-and-done measurement.
You can't just walk across the room once and get a reading. It needs to see you walking naturally over time.
And that's actually a feature, not a limitation. A single walk across the room isn't representative. You're self-conscious, you might be in a hurry, the surface might be unusual. The watch builds a statistical picture of your typical gait, which is much more useful than a single snapshot.
What if you want something more detailed than what a watch gives you?
There's a fantastic free tool called OpenCap. It was developed at Stanford, and it's web-based. You set up two iPhones, or iPads, on tripods, one from the side, one from the front, and you walk across the field of view. The system uses the video to compute three-dimensional joint kinematics, hip angles, knee angles, ankle angles, all in real time. It was originally designed for clinical gait analysis, but it's freely available to anyone.
Two iPhones and a web browser. That's remarkably low barrier. 5 years ago, you'd need a lab that cost more than a house.
It really is. Gait analysis used to require a dedicated lab with a dozen infrared cameras and force plates, costing hundreds of thousands of dollars. Now you can do it in your living room. There's also an app called GaitTrack, developed at the University of Illinois, that uses just your smartphone camera. You prop up the phone, record yourself walking from the side, what's called the sagittal plane, and it extracts gait parameters.
The sagittal plane. That's the side view, right?
It divides the body into left and right. Most gait analysis focuses on the sagittal plane because that's where the major joint movements happen. Hip flexion and extension, knee flexion, ankle dorsiflexion, and plantar flexion. The frontal plane, that's the front view, gives you things like pelvic drop and lateral trunk sway. You want both for a complete picture, but the sagittal plane gets you most of the way there.
For a listener at home, the practical path is, record yourself walking from the side with your phone. Use something like OpenCap or GaitTrack, and you'll get actual numbers. Stride length, cadence, joint angles.
And once you have those numbers, you can start asking interesting questions. How does your gait change when you're tired? When you're in a hurry? When you're listening to music? When you're on the phone?
When you know someone's watching.
That's a real effect, actually. People walk differently when they know they're being observed. It's called the Hawthorne effect, and it applies to gait too. You become more conscious of your movement, and your gait becomes less natural. There's a great example from a 2019 study where researchers told participants their walking was being analyzed for athletic potential. Suddenly, everyone was walking with longer strides and more upright posture. The mere knowledge of observation changed the gait.
To get an honest reading, you'd need to set up the camera and then forget about it, which is basically impossible once you know it's there.
Or do it over many days until the novelty wears off, which is actually what the Apple Watch approach does naturally. You're not thinking about it, you're just walking, and it accumulates data passively. That's the advantage of passive monitoring over active measurement. You trade control for ecological validity.
If gait is this dynamic, mood-influenced signal, what does that mean for you personally? What should a listener actually take away from all this?
First, I think it's important to calibrate expectations. Gait is a useful secondary biometric, but it's not a primary one. Think of it like a voice print or a typing pattern. It adds confidence when combined with other modalities, but you wouldn't want it to be the only thing standing between someone and your bank account. The false acceptance rate of roughly 1 in 100 in real-world conditions just isn't good enough for high-security applications on its own.
When you hear about gait recognition being deployed in surveillance systems, it's almost certainly being used as one signal among many. Face recognition, gait, clothing color, height, build, they're fusing multiple weak signals into a stronger identification.
And that's actually the trend in biometrics generally. No single biometric is perfect, but combine three or four and you get something quite robust. Gait adds value because it works at a distance and doesn't require cooperation. You can't realistically avoid having a gait if you're walking through a public space. Even if you're wearing a mask and a hat and looking down, your gait is still broadcasting. If you want to measure your own gait, the barrier is low. Start with your smartphone. Record yourself walking from the side at a normal pace, about 10 meters of straight walking. Use OpenCap if you have access to two iPhones, or GaitTrack if you just have one. Or if you have an Apple Watch, check your walking steadiness in the Health app. You might be surprised by what you find. Asymmetry, in particular, is something most people don't notice until they see the numbers.
Asymmetry matters because...
Because healthy gait is surprisingly symmetrical. If one leg is doing significantly more work than the other, or if your stance time is uneven, that can indicate an underlying issue, muscle weakness, joint problem, even a neurological asymmetry. Most people have a small amount of natural asymmetry, but anything above about 5% is worth paying attention to. It's the kind of thing that might not cause pain or obvious problems now, but over years it can lead to uneven joint wear and eventually osteoarthritis.
It's like a tire alignment issue. You don't notice it day to day, but over thousands of miles, one side of the tread wears down faster.
That's a perfect analogy. And just like with tires, catching it early is much cheaper and less painful than dealing with the consequences later. Pay attention to how your gait changes with your mood. It's a surprisingly sensitive indicator. If you notice persistent changes, shorter strides, less arm swing, slower pace, over a period of weeks, it might be worth discussing with a healthcare provider. Gait changes can correlate with depression, anxiety, or neurological changes long before other symptoms become obvious.
It's like a canary in the coal mine for your nervous system.
Your walk is a window into your brain in a way that most people don't appreciate. And the nice thing is, you don't need fancy equipment to notice. Just paying attention to how you're moving through space can tell you a lot. Are you swinging your arms less than you used to? Are your steps getting shorter? Do you feel less stable? These are things you can notice without any technology at all.
I'm now going to be self-conscious about my walk for the rest of the day.
That's the hazard of this topic. You can't unthink it. Once you know that your gait is a broadcast, you become aware of the broadcast. It's like when someone points out that you can see your own nose. Suddenly, you can't stop seeing it.
Thanks for that. Now I'm aware of my nose and my walk.
You're welcome. But here's the thing. That self-consciousness fades, and what's left is a new kind of body awareness that's actually useful. You start noticing when something feels off. You become a better observer of your own movement.
We've covered a lot of ground, literally. But there's one big question we haven't answered. As gait recognition becomes more widespread in surveillance and authentication, should we regulate it differently than facial recognition? It's less intrusive in one sense. You can't capture someone's gait from a still photo the way you can with a face. But it's also less reliable. Does that make it more dangerous or less?
That's the paradox. Facial recognition is more accurate but also more regulatable. You can blur faces in footage. You can wear a mask. There are countermeasures. Gait is harder to obscure without drawing attention to yourself. If you walk differently on purpose, you look unusual, which is itself a signal. And with the rise of AR and VR Quest, Apple Vision Pro, full body tracking is being deployed at massive scale. These devices know exactly how you move through virtual space. What happens when companies can identify you by your walk in a virtual environment?
Your gait becomes a persistent identifier across platforms. Your walk in a VR game, your walk through a smart building, your walk past a security camera. They all tie back to the same person without ever needing to see your face. It's a thread that connects your physical and digital movement.
Unlike a password or even a fingerprint, you can't change your gait. You can modify it temporarily, but your natural walk is always there underneath. The horse study showed that even deliberate mood manipulation only dropped accuracy to 78%. The invariant signature persists.
The regulatory question is genuinely hard. On one hand, gait recognition enables some useful applications. Health monitoring, fall prevention, early detection of neurological disorders. On the other hand, it enables persistent, non-consensual identification at scale. And the same properties that make it useful for health make it dangerous for surveillance. The signal doesn't care how it's used.
I don't think we're going to resolve that tension today, but I do think it's worth paying attention to now before the infrastructure is fully built out. Once there are gait recognition cameras in every airport and train station, the policy conversation gets much harder.
It's easier to set norms before the deployment than after. We learned that lesson with facial recognition the hard way.
And that's where I'll leave it. Your walk is more revealing than you think, less unique than some claim, and well worth understanding for yourself. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In 1787, the Matsumae domain in Hokkaido issued a sumptuary edict limiting Ainu commoners to clothing made of elm bark fiber and forbidding the use of cotton, based on a single surviving copy of the ordinance preserved in the Hakodate City Library.
Elm bark fiber. I can't decide if that sounds incredibly uncomfortable or surprisingly soft.
At least it's sustainable. No cotton fields, no pesticides, just...
Thanks to Hilbert Flumingtop for that fact, and to Daniel for the prompt. If you want to measure your own gait, we've given you the tools. The rest is just walking.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Find us at myweirdprompts.com. And if you enjoyed the episode, leave us a review wherever you listen. We'll be here next week, probably walking differently.
Probably overthinking every step, which, honestly, is not a bad way to walk through the world.
As one does. See you next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.